From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Domestic violence incidents spiked during the early part of the pandemic shutdown around the globe. The reasons are well documented. Lockdowns are keeping survivors and their abusers in closer quarters. Courts have slowed operations, and so protective orders can be delayed. And the stress of the pandemic, unemployment, kids at home, can heighten an already tense environment. France, which has one of the highest rates of murder linked to domestic violence in Western Europe, according to the BBC, just passed a law allowing doctors to break patient confidentiality if they believe a life is in immediate danger. The new law also increases prison sentences for abusers whose actions lead a victim to attempt or to commit suicide. In the Cape Fear region, WHQR's Rachel Keith has reported on the rise of domestic violence incidents. Calls for assistance were up more than 100% from mid-March to the end of May as compared to last year. Law enforcement officials tell WHQR that in 2019, during that same time frame, March to May, there were 7 domestic violence protective order violations. This year, during that period, there were 27. But there's a new trend that is causing concern. The Raleigh News and Observer reported in May that the number of people seeking help is dropping off. The New York Times reports a similar trend. The reason that's probably not a positive sign, say survivor advocates, is that victims could be having a harder time finding chances to reach out for help. They could be losing hope. Joining me now to talk about what we're seeing is Liz Herron. She's the director of the Family Justice Center, part of the Durham Crisis Response Center. Liz Herron, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We're so glad to have you with us. And also with us today is a survivor of domestic violence who has bravely agreed to tell her story for the first time publicly, and for her own safety, we are not using her real name. Marie, we are so glad to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me as well.
And we are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a comment about domestic violence, you can reach us during the live discussion on this Wednesday, July 22nd, at coastline@whqr.org. Liz Herron, I want to start with you. This trend being reported about the drop now in calls for help after May, can you unpack for us why this might be happening and what it might mean?
I think it could be due to a number of reasons. I think when you look at survivors who are in the home, there are stay-at-home orders issued. There's still a lot of places that haven't reopened, which can make it even more challenging for survivors to be able to go out in the community and get the resources and assistance they need. They also might not be aware that some places are reopened or the hours might fluctuate because of COVID. So when you look at the court systems, I think you see the same issue sometimes where survivors aren't necessarily aware that the courts are open, or if they are, they're on a limited basis. Sometimes you might see higher calls into hotlines because a phone might be the only tool that a survivor has to use at that time to get help. They might not actually be able to physically leave their home, so they're calling in. But as far as coming in to get more assistance, get a protective order, that's challenging. There's also, the challenge with shelters right now. Because of COVID, they're having to take extra safety precautions, social distancing in shelters. They might not be able to accept as many clients. So it might also be survivors have called in to try to get into shelter, and maybe they can't. So they're kind of feeling like they might not have anywhere to turn right now because of the restrictions and limitations put in place in communities right now.
Marie, I want to talk to you about your story, and thank you again for being willing to share this publicly. It can never be an easy thing to do, and especially this being the first time, I think this is going to be valuable for a lot of people, but we understand how difficult it is. So Start us off with the first time you met the man who would then become your abuser. How did you meet and how did you get into a relationship with him?
We met while we were attending college. We were attending a technical college in Florida. So we became friends while we were at the college, and then we started dating.
And did the abuse creep in over time, or was it something that was kind of there from the beginning?
Well, I got pregnant very early in our dating relationship, which came to, we reached a crossroads of, you know, are we going to continue this or are we going to end the pregnancy? And we made the decision to keep the baby, which then, you know, caused me to have to move in with him. And that is when the abuse started, when I moved in with him. So very early in my pregnancy and in the relationship.
And was there a kind of gradual going from verbal and psychological abuse? Because I know that, well, that's always a part of it, but it was especially with you. He was verbally cruel and psychologically cruel in addition to the physical. Did one come first, or did they kind of all start at the same time?
It more started mentally. He made me feel like I was not the type of person that he would be with. He made it look like I would not be the type of person that his family would approve of him being with. And it wasn't because of my, you know, I was in school. I was a single mom with my oldest at the time. I held on a full-time job and I had my own place when we met, but it was because of my size. Because I'm a plus-size girl, he made it look like I was not the type of female that he would date. So he started to play with my my self-confidence. And from there, it went downhill. It was more of verbally, and then it got physical.
Yeah, and I know this is, it's hard to talk about, and it's hard for people to hear, but how do you go from being a person who is comfortable with your size? Were you already not comfortable, and so you were vulnerable, and he was able to use that? Or did he kind of start to eat away at your self-image? What did he say to you to make you feel that way?
So at that time, I had actually just lost over 60 pounds because I did gain weight from having my first son, and I went on a weight loss journey and lost over 60 pounds. So I was actually feeling very confident about myself before dating him. Because I did have a past of abuse from my mother and her not being in my life, and, you know, he fed off of that. He knew that my mother was no longer in my life. She turned her back on me right during the time that we started dating. So he used that as fuel to make me feel like I had no one else, and, you know, and that I had to solely depend on him. So he started with, I guess that's called gaslighting, I'm not sure, in that narcissistic way. So it was where he made me realize that I had no one else and I had to only depend on him. So even when he said the stuff that he said, it was pretty much where I felt like I had to impress him. I had to impress his family. And he just continued with just belittling me about my size constantly, and that he would never really be in love with me, and stuff like that.
Yeah. And when you think about somebody who might be listening to this right now, I imagine there's so much shame in hearing that from your partner, the person who is the father of your child, the person that you're living with. So help us understand why it is when he first started saying these cruel things to you that you didn't say, that you couldn't feel, that you could get up and leave and just say, that's it, you can't treat me like that. What's going on inside of you?
I just had nowhere to turn. And he made that known that I had no one. I had nowhere to go, and I had nobody. So in that, that is where I developed that mindset that I just couldn't leave. Because if I left, I just had nowhere to go. I would be in the street, pregnant.
Yeah.
And even if I did have somebody to go to or had somebody else, you know, he would find a way to stop it. In other words.
So he was threatening you at that point. Like, even if you did find an outlet, he was going to come after you? Is that what you're saying?
That this was in the beginning of our relationship. So at this point, he just made it known to me and put it in my head that I had nobody else. So mm-hmm. he was the only person who would put up with me and that I had to be with and I had to stay there because, number one, I was carrying his child, and number two, nobody. I had literally nobody to turn to. So right. he made me realize that, and he put that and he fed that into my mindset that it's kind of like where they say you're blind, you know, in a relationship. So that's mm-hmm. all I saw was that I had nowhere else to turn. So I just solely had to depend on him and stay with him.
Yeah. Liz Heron, director of the Family Justice Center. When we come back, I'm going to ask you to speak about how common this kind of a dynamic is in these abusive relationships. You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about domestic violence. When we come back from this break, we'll hear more from Marie as well on how she escaped that situation and turned into a survivor. We'll also hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday, July 22nd at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're taking a closer look at domestic violence, why it spiked in the early part of the pandemic, and how one brave woman, Marie, not her real name, has managed to escape her abuser and begin life again. Also with us today, Liz Heron, director of the Family Justice Center, part of the Durham Crisis Response Center. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday, July 22nd. Just send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. And Liz Heron, just before the break, Marie was describing the assault on her self-confidence that began when she moved in with her abuser, when she discovered that she was pregnant with his child. And also the way he drove home the point that she had nowhere to go. He was all that she had. Can you talk about that dynamic in abusive relationships? Is that always part of it? And why would a survivor initially believe him?
Yes, that absolutely is usually, it's a very common factor when you look at domestic violence. It's all about power and control. And I want to thank Marie for sharing her story and being so brave. And when you look at domestic violence, you know, a lot of times you'll look at cases, they start a relationship. It usually doesn't start off right away like that within the first couple of days or first week, right? You might learn to trust the person, you really care for that person. And then kind of a lot of times the verbal abuse will start. Isolation is huge in domestic violence, which Marie described on how he made her feel very isolated. She had nobody to turn to. Even if she would have had somebody to turn to, he would have either potentially threatened her or found a way to isolate her from that. That is very common. You know, unfortunately, a lot of survivors get isolated even from their own family members. And it's all about power and control. A lot of times, you know, in my experiences when I've spoken with survivors, you know, one of the main things they say is they just want, you know, the violence or the verbal abuse to stop. that this is not the person that they thought or that they initially started a relationship with. And a lot of times that's how it happens and unfolds is it doesn't, the abuse doesn't start off right away. Or most of the time, you know, a lot of times people would usually try to get out of the relationship very early on if that was possible or safe to do so. But it's over time, it slowly builds and really kind of tears down their self-confidence.
Can you talk about the shame factor as well? Because I think, you know, shame can perpetuate itself by not being shared with other people. And mm-hmm. by definition, it's hard to share things that you're ashamed of. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about why a survivor would feel ashamed initially when maybe they have nothing to be ashamed of?
I think, you know, it's a really hard conversation to have. I think some of it is just beginning to, like, first of all, figuring out who you could turn to talk about that. You know, a lot of times survivors, when they're coming in to the Family Justice Center for help, you know, they've probably reached out to several people, maybe friends, maybe family. Maybe they've been so isolated, they don't have anybody to turn to. And they might be embarrassed because, again, that is part of what the offender has made them feel. Their partner has made them feel that it's their fault. And so being able to describe that, a lot of times, you know, they might go to a family member and ask for help or explain what's going on. And they get the reaction, well, why don't you just leave? Well, why are you staying? And that in itself can be very harmful and damaging to say to a survivor, because it's not that easy. It can be very dangerous for somebody to try to leave the relationship unless there is, you know, a safety plan in place. And that's where we really come into play, is we really want to work with survivors and let them know that even if they are in that relationship at the time, we're going to safety plan around that and put together a long-term plan to help get them safe. You know, most of the time when they've come to us, they've probably tried everything they can themselves, right? To change the relationship, get out of the relationship. And it's to the point now they really need help. They've turned to family and friends. Maybe they haven't been supported. Sometimes, unfortunately, you know, when you look at society, there's, you know, systemic challenges and problems where they're not necessarily believed. So that's another challenge that happens, and I think makes it harder for people to speak out. They might have had negative interactions with law enforcement or with perhaps a judge maybe in the past. So it just makes it even more challenging sometimes for them to speak out about what's happened to them.
Marie, what was that like for you the first time law enforcement got involved after an incident of abuse? What was your experience like?
The first time that law enforcement actually got involved, he was intoxicated, and we had our second child together, which is our daughter. She was an infant, and he was choking me while she was in my hands. And I called law enforcement, but that was my first experience seeing where it was more as it was taken very lightly. They let him go. They just asked him to leave. I had visible bruises. You know, my daughter was in my hands, and I didn't take it seriously.
You had visible
experience.
I'm sorry, Marie. I just want to make sure that people hear this. You had visible bruises. Your infant mm-hmm. daughter is in your arms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not taken seriously? They asked him to leave, meaning leave your
premises, leave our home where we were living together, and they just had him leave. He was intoxicated, and they just made him leave.
Can you explain why they didn't offer you a chance to press charges or do anything further? Do you understand what happened there? Or, I mean, Liz, can you help
honestly,
us here?
Like, I feel like that night was such a vortex. Like everything was just spinning because I couldn't believe that this was happening. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, this was my first time contacting the police in a situation. And this wasn't the first time that it's happened, you know. Each time I was it was like a joke to the law enforcement. Even up till the time when the last incident happened, they were laughing at me when they were taking my pictures because of my size.
What? That, Liz, this is really hard to comprehend. Laughing at a victim of domestic violence because of her size? Can you help us here?
It's really hard to comprehend, and it's really upsetting, and it's really hard to hear and listen to. You know, I want to go back to what Marie said about being like strangled. You know, sometimes you'll hear survivors refer to it as being choked also. And I think, you know, some of it, as far as strangulation goes, has to do with like a lack of training on law enforcement. You know, I've been to some really, really good trainings on strangulation. And there's new research to show now that even if you don't have visible bruises on the outside, that a lot of the damage on strangulation cases is actually done internally. So you would not actually see that. It wouldn't be visible. And the problem is that law enforcement typically is looking for very visible injuries. And so I think they just have this, you know, they have an idea of what domestic violence should look like, maybe how a domestic violence survivor should be acting, how a defendant should be acting. And we know that there is no cut and dry, clear picture of that. Trauma is different for every survivor too, when they respond. And I think sometimes law enforcement, you know, doesn't quite understand trauma, doesn't quite understand, you know, you don't have to have physical marks on your body. And that's what they look for, you know, and unfortunately that's not always the case.
Is it also possible if Marie isn't hysterical in the moment because she's a mother and she's trying to cope and she's got a baby in her arms, so she can't afford to let herself go? Is it possible that because she isn't what they think, you know, a hysterical person, that it must not have been as bad as she says it was?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've seen that before too. You know, I think sometimes folks might think that survivors should be crying hysterically, you know, and that's not the case. Like you said, she's a mother. Probably her first priority at the time was to make sure the baby was okay. She might be trying to stay calm for the baby. Again, people react very differently to trauma. There's no right way to react to trauma, you know? And sometimes you might even see when police officers are there, the perpetrator might actually be very calm. And so they think, you know, well, this person's really calm. They couldn't have just assaulted and done this, but that's actually not the case, you know? And especially when you look at perpetrators who, are physically violent or constantly abusive to them, they are calm because they're kind of used to doing it, right? It's not out of their norm necessarily for them to behave that way.
Yeah. So Marie, so what was it that he did the time that you called law enforcement first? What was it that made you pick up the phone and call?
That was the first time I felt like he was going to kill me. And I saw it in his eyes. His eyes were bloodshot red. I mean, he was intoxicated, but I felt like he had no control, because not even the fact that my daughter was in my hand made him realize that he needed to stop what he was doing. And I'm trying to remember that night exactly why, because I don't think that I wanted him to go to jail at that time because we had kids. I wanted him for them to do what they had to do. But again, this was my first time going through this as far with the police involved. This was not the first time that he had put his hands on me. This was the first time I actually had to call the police and get them involved. And I just wanted it to stop.
Yeah.
I felt like maybe calling the police that time, that it would let him know that I'm not afraid to call the police. But they just told him to just leave and just go cool down and sober up and to leave the house.
And so you said you had several incidents with law enforcement when you called and essentially got little or no help. When did you actually get help? Think about that day when things shifted for you? What happened?
Honestly, the first time I ever felt like I got help from law enforcement was here in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Because even when the last incident happened while I was living in Florida, where he choked me again, and then this time he threw me against the toilet. Our son was 5 years old at the time. He was in the bathroom with us. He started punching me. He wasn't slapping me. He wasn't holding me. He was punching me as if I was a man in my body, like all different parts of my body. Even after that, my cousin took me to the police station, and I have visible bruises all throughout my body. The police still didn't make me feel like I was safe. He was able to run to a different county, and he told them he knew that they would be looking for him, so he left and went to another county. So they weren't able to arrest him. They weren't able to do anything, really. And, you know, I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel like I could trust law enforcement at that time. So the first time I've ever felt like I was safe was when I came back to North Carolina.
And who did you connect with in North Carolina? Is that when you went to the Family Justice Center and met Liz Heron? Or what was your first kind of walking through that doorway where you could exhale and say, okay, I think I might be safe now. I might be on the right track.
The first door was actually the Durham, one of the police stations here in my area. I walked in with them because he was then threatening to come to find me here in North Carolina. And because he has popped up here before, and I had to move from where I was and where I live currently. He doesn't know where I live now, so he was trying to find where I live, including calling the kids' school and trying to get information on where I live. And I went to the local police station, and they directed me to the Family Justice Center.
So you were actually trying to kind of escape him on your own. You weren't getting professional help in terms of your escape. You fled one state, came to North Carolina. He found you. So you were all trying to do all this on your own with the help of a cousin, maybe?
Yes. When I left, I moved up here with some friends and got my life started up here. I was supposed to go back down to... because the state attorney's office was actually trying to prosecute him, but because the person who was there as a witness and a key witness took back her statement, my actual family member who took me to the police station took back her statement and did not no longer want to testify. And they said that even though my son's testimony told the truth, he was a child at the time, so they said the best thing for me to do was to be where I am, which is in North Carolina, for my safety, because they honestly felt like he was going to hurt me when they interviewed him. So I just kept trying to find my peace here. I filed for divorce because we were married. So I filed for divorce here on my own. And that was how he got my previous address, because my address was on the divorce paperwork because I had to file him myself.
Right. And so now you're in danger again, since he
knows
where you live.
Because then he was threatening again. He showed up at my door. I've always kept him in his kid's life. So I let the kids spend a day with him. But then because I wouldn't do what he asked, he's very controlling. So if I don't do things his way, that's when he erupts. And he was threatening to come and take my kids. I did. He started sending police to my residence. He started harassing my son. So it started to escalate. And then that's when I had to go to the police station. And then that is when they directed me to the Family Justice Center. So, yes, I've been pretty much trying to do this on my own.
Liz Heron of the Family Justice Center, can you kind of walk us through what the process could be for someone who is trying to escape a situation like this? I know you've worked in a couple of different jurisdictions, including New Orleans, and depending on where you are, the process can be pretty different and the resources available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It really depends on, you know, kind of like the state and the county, even within the state that you live in. And so at the Family Justice Center in Durham, we get a lot of walk-ins who are referred to us, either maybe by the police, maybe by the district attorney's office, maybe by another community partner, that is aware of us and they, you know, they're working with, say, a survivor on something else and realize what's going on. Therapists sometimes might refer them to us, schools even. And so we, so when a client comes in, we really just want to find out what their needs are and kind of do an assessment, and see what they want. You know, we are going to support the survivor in whichever they choose to do. If they want to make a police report, we can assist them with that. If they don't want to, that's fine. And I think you'll see that, kind of in a lot of different community agencies that are working with survivors. They're very supportive of what the survivor's needs are. And so then there's several different options. You want a safety plan. You could potentially look at shelter. You could look at filing protective orders. You know, in New Orleans, I worked for the district attorney's office. So, it was a little bit different of a role, but there, you know, my job was to work with the domestic violence, survivors that were part of criminal cases, to make sure that they had resources to help keep them safe. But then also keep them updated on what was going on with the actual court cases as well. Because we know, you know, with survivors involved in the justice system, sometimes that can be another safety risk for them, if they're having to come in.
Yeah, and we're gonna continue that point when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. We're looking at domestic violence, how it's unfolding amid the pandemic. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday, July 22nd. By emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your own question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Domestic violence incidents spiked around the globe in the early part of the pandemic shutdown. As the weeks and months wore on, calls for assistance dropped dramatically. Some advocates worry the reason for the drop may be victims running out of opportunities and hope. My two guests today understand the issue from the inside. Marie, not her real name, is bravely telling her story of survival for the first time publicly. Liz Heron is the director of the Family Justice Center, part of the Durham Crisis Response Center. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday, July 22nd, by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Liz Heron of the Family Justice Center, just before we went to break, you were explaining some of the differences in process and resources as you go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But when you look at Marie's story specifically, and she talks about having multiple interactions with law enforcement before she really got help, what would you say to a victim who might be listening now and who has been shamed by law enforcement or hasn't found a portal into a new life, a portal to safety through law enforcement? What are the options here in North Carolina?
I would say, you know, there's several options. So we know, you know, and a lot of the community agencies will assist you with what your needs are, and law enforcement does not have to be involved. That can be your choice. So if somebody is not interested in involving law, we support that. Most counties, the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence is a great place to start with resources. In the state of North Carolina, they actually have a list in each county of like a hotline number to call or the community agency that they can call. And so that's a good place to start. You know, if you want to find community agencies, anybody can even pick up the phone. If somebody say were to call us in Durham and maybe they don't live in Durham, we still are going to work with them to do a safety plan and provide resources in the area that they live in.
And I just want to say on that note, in Wilmington, North Carolina, Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, the Open Gate, is an incredible program. And we've had them on Coastline before, and they do excellent work. And they are absolutely available. In fact, they spoke with WHQR's Rachel Keith about some of the coverage that she's done of this on the issue during the pandemic. So I just want to make sure that local folks know Domestic Violence Shelter and Services in Wilmington. So yeah, go ahead. But people can also call you in Durham.
Yeah, absolutely. And really probably any agency they pick up the phone and they can get a hold of, they could call the coalition. The coalition could give them resources. They could call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. You know, most community agencies are very willing to try to, like, our number one goal is to help keep a survivor safe. So whatever we need to do to make that happen, we're going to do that. So if that is us, you know, communicating with Wilmington, with Open Gate, we're going to absolutely do that. We usually will go ahead and make those referrals. We'll pick up the phone ourselves instead of, you know, just giving a number to a survivor and saying, hey, we'll call this place. We'll actually try to step in and assist with that too, to make sure that they're actually getting connected with an advocate in another county or with another agency that they need to.
And that advocate or that agency will actually help that person create an escape plan, right?
Yes.
It's not something that you do in a day, by the way. You don't just pack your suitcase and decide this is it and get out.
Right. And because we know, you know, that a lot of times the most at risk a survivor is when they're trying to leave that relationship or when they've just left. Unfortunately, that is when the majority of domestic violence homicides occur, is when somebody is actually trying to leave the relationship. So we know that it is a process to leave, and we are here to support, you know, survivors through that process, help them put together a plan. And we know plans change too. You know, safety plan is constantly going to be changing. And it could change from day to day too. And so that's something we're constantly working on safety plans with survivors.
And I want to raise this issue of talking with Marie, who is with us today, not her real name. She is bravely sharing her story of survival and escaping domestic violence for the first time publicly. There are some advocates that wouldn't condone putting Marie on the air, even though we're not using her real name. Can you, Liz, sort of talk about that tension between having somebody who's really been through it and knows what goes along with that, you know, the feelings of powerlessness and isolation and shame and fear and all of it?
Absolutely.
Why that's important versus, you know, the good arguments to be made for not putting Marie through something like this.
Absolutely. And, you know, we take it very seriously when we talk to survivors like Marie about doing things like this. 100%, it is always their choice. We are never going to try to get somebody to do that because we understand what that could feel like, what that could potentially be like. We never want to put pressure on them, but we also find it very important for survivors to be able to share their story. They're getting their voice back. A lot of times they've had people telling them what to do. They haven't had any power. They haven't been able to make decisions. And we would like to give them this option so that they can actually speak about what happened to them and tell their story. I think it's also really important for folks to listen to survivors because they're the ones who can tell us best on what they need, right? We're not in a place to tell them what they need. They're the expert on their lives. They're the expert on the perpetrator. So we really want to listen to them. And that's how we learn is from listening. And so we feel it's really important for them to be able to use their voice to help us better understand what their needs are and what they need and want.
Marie, you talked about your last straw being the day that your abuser attacked you in front of your 5-year-old son. And you've talked about going to parenting classes now as part of your new life. What are the effects on the kids, and how are you kind of talking to the kids now that you're out of that situation and they're out of that situation about what happened?
I'll start with my daughter, who was only, she was about 2 at the time, so she doesn't remember any of it. So when it comes to her, it's a different type of conversation. She doesn't really remember him. She doesn't really know him. So she, based on what he's done recently and what she heard in speaking with him and the vibe that she gets from him, she doesn't feel comfortable being around him. My then 5-year-old son, who's 12 now, he doesn't have a relationship with him anymore. He has tried, but his father has definitely damaged that relationship. And my oldest, who has seen more, as well, he has no relationship with him at all. He does not like him. He does not like to be around him. My going back to my 12-year-old son now, I have to have a lot of talks with him. I have to, you know, tell him not to hate his father. I have to still encourage a relationship with him and his father. I let him, because he's very mature for his age, I let him come to that decision of what relationship he wants to build with his father. But I'm not forcing him. I'm letting him make those decisions on his own. But it has affected him the most because he was right there. Right after the incident happened, because that day his father was walking around and calling me names, you know, the B word and a whore and stuff throughout the entire day, my 5-year-old then, you know, repeated what he said to me. So I had to then, you know, tell him that even though he heard those things, it's not okay to say that to mommy, you know. And it's been a process. It's been a challenge, because I know that certain things as kids, when you see certain things, you then it's possible that it can be implemented when they grow up. So it's just constantly talking to him and letting him know that that is not him, that is not who he is going to become, and just uplifting him and letting him know that that is still his father, no matter what. That is still he has to have a relationship some way, somehow, with his father, and that's up to him, the type of relationship that he does choose to have with him. But I've never been the type of mother that ever, you know, wanted to keep him from his kids or having a relationship for his kids. It is a journey, and it's a process that we deal with just on a daily basis.
And do you have a counselor with you to help you navigate that journey right now?
At this moment, no. I did get offers. I did have that option presented to me. My son just does not feel comfortable being a counselor right now.
Yeah. And you said that you had been to parenting classes as part of, you know, developing this new life. What did you learn in parenting classes that you didn't know before?
Well, when I went to the parenting class, it did, you know, educate me on how to parent apart, how to put our emotions, or really my emotions, to the side and do what's in the best interest of my children. So that was the main thing that I learned from the parenting class, was just learning how to parent apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Liz Heron, going back to this idea of making an escape plan, and as you've pointed out, this can be the riskiest time for the survivor. And so making a plan is such an important part of this. The first step, you're saying, would be to contact an advocate like Domestic Violence Shelter and Services, the Open Gate in Wilmington, or the Durham Crisis Response Center in Durham. What does a plan look like? What can it look like for somebody?
So Every survivor's plan is definitely going to be different. No matter what, it's always going to be different because there's different factors you take into place, you know, especially if there's children involved. Like Marie was saying, you know, she still was wanting her children to be able to maintain a relationship with their father. So that's something too you really need to take into consideration when making these safety plans. You know, and it can be really, really, you basically would kind of start in the home with where they are. Are they, you know, our number one question is, are you safe right now? Are you safe in the home? Do you need to get out immediately? Talking about who their support system is. If they do have children, talking about how they can also have a conversation with their children about safety, right? If they can't leave right at that time, putting together a plan for how, if something, if an incident does start to happen, where can they go? Where can the kids go? Do the kids know how to call 911 or can they call 911? Is there a door that the children can leave from? Do they have access to a cell phone? You know, sometimes that's something that perpetrators will take and maybe damage. They might take their cell phone. They might also put listening devices on their cell phone too. So that is another factor you want to consider is it even safe for them to use a phone to reach out? If they have a vehicle, is there, you know, we've had cases, unfortunately, where there's been a tracker problem, like that somebody's put a tracker on their car. So it can just be a number, you know, a number of things. If they have a job, is the perpetrator contacting their job? Are they showing up at their job? So it really kind of depends on, you know, if they're living together, if they're not living together, that's going to look differently. If the perpetrator knows where their family lives. So there's just a lot of different factors to take into play.
Yeah. And Marie, we have just a couple of minutes left, but if you could speak directly to someone who is in a violent situation right now in the home, someone who feels trapped, what would you say to that person?
Don't be afraid to make that first step to get out. It's hard because it's more of a mental entrapment than actual physical. You feel in your mind that you have nowhere to go, you have nowhere to turn. I will say that just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of what others will think of you, because at times, you know, we want to portray, you know, that we're living in this fantasy, this happy home, and this behind closed doors are going through such trauma. You know, don't be afraid of what people think. Just, you know that there's options out there. And there's people that can help you and that can take you to your peace. That was the most important thing that I realized now, is that I needed that peace, that sense of peace in my life. So don't feel like there's no help. Don't feel like there's nowhere to turn. Just take that first step, and then everything else will fall into place.
And Liz Heron, is there a number that people can call? An easy number to just put out there? We will certainly put all of the resources on our website at whqr.org at the end of this show, but who should people call?
They can call Durham, our advocate line. One of our advocate lines is 919-450-8970. We've also got a crisis line in English and Spanish. But as I know that in Wilmington, there's open gates. I don't have their number off the top of my head, but I'm sure it'll be on your website. So,
yes, it will be. And that number is 910-343-0703 for domestic violence shelter and services. That's this edition of Coastline. Liz Heron, thanks for being with us. And Marie, thank you for being willing to share your story with our listeners. We all wish you much happiness and success as your bright future unfolds.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.